Okay, welcome everyone to our symposium sponsored by the UCEA Center for the Advanced Study of Technology and Education. That's a real mouthful, we did say CASEL. CASEL was UCEA's newest center. We've been around about a year, maybe a little more. And basically we're founded on the idea that just like UCEA has centers for school finance and the superintendency and urban leadership, etc., that there's also a need to have a place focusing on the technology needs of school administrators. So we're delighted to have you all here, and we're delighted to see our latest wave of participants. So we've got stuff to give you. So grab a seat, and we'll pass some stuff out. We're going to go ahead and do introductions. John, you're first on the list. So quickly about yourself.
Okay, I'm John Becker. I'm assistant professor in the Department of Foundations, Leadership, and Policy Studies in the School of Education and Allied Human Services at Hofstra University.
Wow.
How's that?
Great. Well, let Sarah introduce herself. We'll let Sarah introduce herself if she shows up. Matt, 2 cents about yourself. I mean, you're also blocking the projector, dude.
The real technology in my head. Matt Motel, University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Educational Research, Policy, and Administration.
Okay, David?
I'm David Glenn. I'm at the University of Florida in Edmund Policy and Higher Education.
Oh, and me. So I'm at the University of Minnesota and have been there for a while. And I'm the director of CASEL along with my co-director, Joan Hughes, who's in Curriculum and Instruction. We're going to start off with a little mindset stuff. So this is going to be an interactive symposium. You have index cards and clickers and all kinds of fun stuff that we're going to play with during this session. But we're going to start off. Oh, hi, Sarah. You're just in time to introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Sarah Dexter from the University of Virginia. A little lost.
Yep. All right, Sarah, grab a chair. We're going to watch a 7-minute video. So sit back, relax. I've got to change this. Okay, got to drag it right to it. So, let me give you some background here. This was a video made by Carl Fish, who is a staff development specialist in Colorado, and he made this video for his staff. Okay, at the beginning of the school year, and it's gotten lots of play on the educational technology blogosphere, and so I invite you to watch and think. So, everybody can see the screen? We're all good? Here we go. Oh, hang on. Live by the tech, die by the tech. Let's try that again. Down. Okay, there you go. This is called Did You Know? Okay, discussion. So for our panelists, and by the way, our panelists have no idea what this session is structured like, so they're as surprised as you are at anything we do in the next hour. For the panel, what do we think the world's going to look like 30, 40 years from now, and what kind of skills and knowledge are today's school kids going to need to thrive in this world? Anybody want to take a first shot at that?
We don't know.
That's all you got for me, Dave? We don't know.
Seriously, we don't know. I mean, how many people would have predicted the internet in 1950 and what the internet's done for us? Right. What's the internet of 2040?
Anyone else want to pick on this easy question?
Well, it seems that one thing is clear that we can predict is that the ability to learn, the information skills, the knowledge management skills are really the only consistent set of things that are always probably going to be true about what's necessary to deal with what you don't know concretely will be the set of knowledge, will be the actual capabilities and such. So,
Sarah, talk a little bit more about what you mean by ability to learn knowledge management.
Well, you know, I think actually people probably do understand what I mean, but to elaborate a bit so that, you know, the things that were called like thinking skills curriculum and have translated into understanding of information skills, and now I think are more so referred to as, you know, the knowledge society, the knowledge management skills, being able to access information on demand, be able to process it, be able to communicate it. Those are the kinds of things that are enduring qualities because they're independent of what the actual facts are. And so that seems clear that it is, and actually that has been consistently emphasized by some degree of proponents over the years, like since the 1980s when, you know, it was called the thinking skills curriculum in schools. Do people remember that, that movement, right? And so it just kind of shifts in terms of how much it gets to be emphasized and how exactly it's described. I think the people that recognize those enduring skills as something important to emphasize in K-12 schools, you know, what the language is has changed a bit over the last 25 years. There's always a group of people that consistently recognize that what are, those are enduring things to develop in kids. And so the rationale for that, you know, if it's China's going to eat us up or whatever, those things shift, right? But, I, you know, that to me seems like the only thing we can't predict is that, that those qualities are enduring ones.
So we have a two max rule in this room, which means we can hear from no more than two panelists before we have to hear from somebody from the audience. So, somebody in the crowd, what are you thinking? Yeah. Introduce yourself, please.
Quinn Arana.
From?
University of Oklahoma.
Okay.
When I think of the world in 30 or 40 years, one thing I think of is that since we're probably moving to that closer than probably in 30, 40 years, is data and facts available instantly, including to children. And, you know, I guess, what are the implications of that?
Okay, so what do you mean data and facts are available instantly?
Well, now, I can go, if I need to find out something, you know, I can go search on the internet. I could imagine in 30 or 40 years there would be some device that has pretty much all information available instantly.
Okay.
I agree with that, although I think language is really important, and so I think data will be available instantly, but the word facts is difficult for me because that to me is the issue. I mean, David Warlick, who's writing this stuff, talks about redefining literacy for the 21st century. I mean, kids will really need to have to learn, will really have to learn what, how to decipher facts from fiction, maybe, I don't know, but to really understand, to maybe to think critically about the information they are able to access 24/7, 365.
Art Harkins, who's a futurologist at the University of Minnesota, talks about the fact that we can already see this trend happening where, you know, whether it's a PDA or a cell phone or something, that you can imagine a device that sits on your shoulder or clips to your belt or whatever. And as connectivity increases, so for example, as we start having wide-ranging network connections, so literally you're connected to the internet no matter where you are, that you can literally turn to this thing and with the advances that we're already seeing in voice recognition technology, say, hey, what's the capital of Delaware? And it'll just spit it back out at you. You know, it'll speak it, you know. And that's not an unforeseeable scenario because we already have those technologies. We just haven't put them all together yet and we haven't quite got the connectivity yet. But that's not really like a far out thing. So then the question becomes, for example, if you can have instant access to all the world's information, like what's the value of like memorizing things? You know,
I'm worried
like
about that now.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Actually, I think it's in terms of conversation, because if I could never speak of anything concrete, if I don't have any declarative knowledge, how can I talk about anything?
Sure.
What I was going to say is they'll have to have the ability to have a crap detector. And the difference between relevant and irrelevant data that are coming in. And that to me is what's so tough. And what's priority, what's not priority.
But, you know, I think it's really interesting to think about it's the impact of data available or facts, you know, this sort of futurist thing that Scott just mentioned. Because, you know, it's your interest in particular facts that make for a community of people. Like, we're all interested in this topic, and so we showed up in this hot little room right now, right? And, you know, we have some shared ideas, or at least interests, and we have some facts that we probably share in common and such, and that allows us to have a conversation about it. And so if people never memorize anything or have internalized any particular things, it would not let you have very many conversations about things, because you don't really have conversations on processes, right? I mean, you can study that, but still then you have it as your content, right? So it could be a very fracturing of things, because if people don't need to learn facts and then they only want to, then you would only end up, you know, having things in common, perhaps. I mean, there's probably still some compelling reasons to have particular things that all kids should know, not just all kids should be able to do. You know what I mean? It's what we share as a larger society, perhaps.
So anybody want to take a stab at the second question, which is, if we know that our future is fairly unknown, right? David mentioned, for example, even just 20 years ago, we couldn't really imagine the internet. So what kind of skills and knowledge are the kids that we're teaching now going to need? Because, you know, the 8-year-old now is 28, 38, 48 in the next few decades.
Yes. I just have a question. Who's responsible for who gets to know what?
Oh, yeah.
Too much information in the wrong hands could make us look like the Stone Ages in 30 to 40 years. Information on how to proliferate nuclear weapons fell into the hands of someone who wasn't disciplined enough to use that. I don't know if you use a weapon in a positive way, but you know what I'm saying? If that too much information got into the hands that had devious intentions, 30 or 40 years, you know, we're going to be sitting around a campfire wondering what we're going to do.
Okay.
I just want to respond to that, because I hear that. I think that's a really, really important point. And that when I talk to my students about that, their response is, you know, and their school administrators, their response is, well, let's shut down. You know, let's block information as much as possible. And I think that's really problematic for me. You know, I'd rather have conversations with them about what you said and talk about what it all means and how to process the information that they find.
And I think that's one of the skills in a world where information is available all the time, whenever you want it. Then you've got to figure out how to make moral decisions about it, and you've got to be able to connect with other people, or we're going to end up being a bunch of social isolates. So
but who's moral? Well, making a moral decision is probably based on where you're sitting, and maybe in a room like this halfway around the world, where that moral decision is one that you've been an infidel. So that's my question, is who's responsible for how much information gets disseminated to that? Because it's not only available here, it's available anywhere.
Well, and John and I had an interesting discussion this morning, I guess it was, about a school district that he's familiar with. Of course, we won't name it. It's a very affluent school district, and they basically have decided that they don't need to really do anything in the realm of technology because the kids all have it at home. You know, John and I talked about our concerns that, well, you know, where's the socialization role in schools? Where's, just because the kids have the technology doesn't mean that they're wise about it, or they know how to make good moral, ethical choices as adults. And this idea of just we're going to, or even if we have it at school, we're going to shut it down, we're going to lock it down, doesn't teach kids how to make choices when they're not in school, right? They're going to still go home and have access to that information through those tools. And yet if the school says, well, we don't have to get involved in that, the parents will just take care of it. You know, what does that mean for us?
It's interesting to talk about what's happening with technology halfway around the world. I spent this year close to 5.5 weeks in China doing research, actually mostly in the western part of China, which is a very high Muslim population, very rural, with high school principals, primary school principals, and superintendents. And there is no technology there. There is none. There is no computers. There is no infrastructure. China and most of the stats you see there, that is Hong Kong, Singapore, and Beijing is the coast, and there really isn't a West. It's a government's concern. The Communist Party just wants to make sure that they hang on to them. But this last trip I went to, I actually did spend some time in Beijing and went to the key schools, which are just amazing. But, you know, if you took any one of our school districts and pulled out that 1%, put them into these schools with technology. And I asked them a lot about how they were using technology. I was, you know, knowing that there's a lot of restrictions in the governmental, the Communist Party, in terms of where they can and cannot go. I was thinking these high schoolers were really hungry for information that they didn't necessarily receive or couldn't read about through government-controlled newspapers, magazines, and TV. But it was downloading music, and they knew how to download music in legal and illegal ways. And they were listening to things like Korn and Linkin Park. And I was pleasantly surprised. And a lot of the communication skills. And that's what I was trying to get to. they because of the amount of homework they have every night, and because of the way that their parental involvement, there is no parental involvement with homework. It's a cultural thing, not that the parents don't have the capacity. Just, this is, you know, you have 2 hours of homework tonight. You need to sit here and deal with it. But now more than ever, they're communicating, text messaging. You know, these kids at the key schools have computers at home. They're on the telephone. And so there's this issue of how, I mean, this whole issue that Sarah did a nice job of trying to conceptualize about how we take information in and decipher it, but also how you communicate yourself and what we do about that. I mean, this, the 8-minute presentation didn't talk about cell phones. We think we have a lot of cell phones in the United States, and you go to China, and everybody's got at least one, everyone. And it's just, even in the western part of China, it's just amazing.
By the way, part of the answer to your question about who controls, who's responsible for what information, part of the answer might be Google. Think about how much control they have over what type of information we get. It's kind of a scary thought, but.
It seems to me that in an uncertain, unknowable future, as several people have said, that it's really this idea of how do we teach kids to learn, right? And unlearn and relearn as the paradigm shift.
So really a responsibility, I think, becomes to schools to be able to more quickly adapt to changes in the skill set that should be taught, developments of new knowledge. You know, we've all are familiar with some of the reasons why it's difficult for schools to adapt and to change as organizations. And it seems that, you know, that is one of the most pressing needs that a lot of this implies, I believe, for schools, is that they just have to become more adept as organizations to be able to adapt quickly to changes out in the world, the global level of things and societal needs and such.
Threw a quick quote up for you guys to stew on for just a second. Okay, time for your clickers. Grab your clickers. So here's a question for you. Do you talk about these issues in your Ed Leadership program? Strongly agree, one, agree, two. Point your clicker at my laptop and just push 1, 2, 3, or 4. I've got 12 responses. Put them at my laptop, 16, 17. You're doing great.
Will it count it twice?
No. So whatever you push last. Okay, we're up to 18 responses. That's probably most of you. Ready? And here we go.
Okay.
That's pretty good.
Probably. I'd like to do that in the room.
Yeah. Yeah. Random sample of any room over here.
Any reactions or thoughts about our results? Do you think these are typical of Ed Leadership programs across the country?
My thoughts are thinking about being at UCA 4 years ago, when we had these meetings, and we had 3 people, you know, in these types of meetings, and we still do have some of the smaller sessions, like this morning, but,
Well, I was at 7.
No guilt,
but then Friedman wrote The World is Flat, right?
Yeah. What is time anyway?
So, any thoughts from the audience?
Well, we were discussing how the UCA was kind enough to provide overhead projectors.
Oh, to put your projectors on.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It would make you be too low.
Okay. Right. Any other thoughts on the
I think that those of us who were attracted to the session are those of us who are talking.
Okay. So this represents the bulk of Ed Leadership conversation across the country.
Well, let's just do a quick hand raise. If you were one of the people in that voted number 1 or 2, raise your hand. That if it was you, or no, let's say, if you said in your program it's agree or strongly agree, and you're the one who does that, you said that because you know you talk about it, raise your hand.
That's a good question.
Okay. So, one thing that immediately came to mind is I wondered in which courses, just any course, because that's something that you think needs to be talked about, or is it in a technology course, or is it in a school?
We talked about it in our leadership and change course that I think is going to be taking. We really, I mean, The World is Flat is one of the books that the students read. So we did talk about change, and change being the only constant.
Interestingly, just take a quick poll as to who's from where. Just in looking around here, we're in a doctoral cohort through the K-20 Center at OU. And so that discussion permeates everything we do. And it is, because it's a virtual...
It's kind of an outlier. Technology, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Leadership, right. Emphasis in technology. Right. And so you've got, how many of us here?
Raise your hand.
Look, how many of us are
Probably a Luddites in here, technology Luddites.
They are all in that technology cohort, but I am in the School of Instructional Leadership and Academic Curriculum, which is one of the other schools at OU, which is where I started my PhD program. Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. I took one technology class as a PhD.
Okay, here we go. About 3 minutes. One more video. 3 minutes. Another more background. This is a video made by Consuela Molina. I'm sure I'm not saying that right because I'm not a Spanish speaker. She is a graduate of Marcos Torres, who does a phenomenal digital video technology program in the high school that he works at. Okay. So, one more quick quote for you.
Make the alcohol people just want to
know. That's all right. You have to come to a consensus.
Okay. In our program, we integrate current digital technologies into our instruction. Vote away.
We.
You want to vote for the typical of the leadership program? We'll do that instead of yours. We anticipate the Oklahoma visit. Okay. All right, everybody got that anchored in your head? Mm-hmm. Next question, grab your clickers. In our program, we're preparing pre-service administrators to be leaders in the area of technology. Vote away. Okay. Higher than you would expect, probably.
Probably
Oklahoma, given the Oklahoma folks.
Sorry.
So it's a doctor in tech leadership. We like that. In our program, we're preparing pre-service administrators to be future-oriented leaders. Mm-hmm. That would be in contrast to, say, reactionary leaders.
Who'd say no?
We'll see.
There you go. Quite a
few. We're in trouble.
Okay, Wesley Fryer took Mark Prensky's language, where Mark Prensky talks about the dichotomy of the digital natives, the digital immigrants, and Prensky talks about the fact that the kids today are digital natives. They basically grow up immersed in the digital environment, right? And that most of us who are older are digital immigrants, if we're coming to it at all, right? We're trying to make our way in a land that we're not that familiar with. He expanded Prensky's dichotomy to talk about digital refugees. These are the people that either are trying to avoid the technology altogether, or they're trying to deny that it exists. There's people who are bridges. For example, I would probably consider myself a bridge between these two groups. And then there's people who are undecided and just not quite sure what's happening. So think about those five roles for a minute, and think about which one you are, and then we're going to vote. Okay? All right, so how would you categorize yourself? lots of digital immigrants, some of us are bridgers, only one of us is in it. No refugees, that's good. Okay, thoughts, reactions to what we've talked about so far?
So, I'd like to know who the native is.
Yeah, I mean, we've kind of taken the move here from sort of the generalized idea of what do kids need to know in the future, right? To, okay, now these kids are hitting universities, you know, what's our obligation to prepare graduate students in this area? What's our capacity and capability to prepare these people? So,
I'd like to ask the question.
Yeah.
Where did they get their information? Have they been applying for jobs and they've been turned down because the students in the deal? Did they send in applications? They weren't qualified, so they were turned down. Mm-hmm. What they think they're going to need to be prepared for? Where are they drawing these conclusions from? Because a lot of times when you sit down with industry leaders, they're saying we want people who are responsible, we want people who are trustworthy, we want people who won't steal a company's line, won't shop eBay while they're supposed to be done. I mean, you know, we've said in industry meetings where they're not complaining about the preparedness. I think I've said too much.
Well, and that sort of contrasts with Richard Florida's whole thing. How many of you read Rise of the Creative Class by Richard Florida? A couple of you? Okay, where he talks about, he's traced the development of, there's this group of workers in society that he calls creative workers. They're attorneys, they're professors, they're people who have the ability to create and be creative and be thoughtful. They're not the line workers, right? And they're not the service positions, and they're not the people working at McDonald's. And they're not agricultural workers, and you know, they're not machinists. And that population has actually grown significantly since 1980. So where it used to be 5% of the population back in around 1900, or about 1980, it was around 10-15%, and now that's already up to about a third of our population. And so as the more lower skill jobs continue to move to other places, right, where they can do this at lower wages, the proportion of creative workers within our society continues to grow. And so I think what the students are reacting to is that they're seeing that trend play out, and they may not have been specifically rejected. And employers, yes, they still want people who can, you know, be responsible and show up on time and do whatever. But the characteristics of the job itself, in terms of what they're doing, has changed significantly. And those are the jobs that make the money. Those are the jobs that, you know, put you in the solid middle class and or upper class and allow you to move forward and, you know, live in nice neighborhoods and have nice houses and go to good schools and all that kind of stuff, right? And so those are the desirable jobs. And what Florida then goes on to talk about is that certain cities are better at attracting capable creative talent than other areas are. So a place like an Austin, or a Seattle, or a Denver, or a Boston, or Minneapolis, for example, those are known for being magnets for creative, talented people. And they have very different expectations about their jobs than the old sort of organization mandate where you showed up, you punched the clock, you were seated, did whatever you were told. You know, you did your time, hoping you get promoted eventually and off. And these people are demanding job flexibility and creativity and the ability to work flex hours and all that kind of stuff. So it's a very different work world than it used to be. Yes.
But isn't a lot of that, you know, those kinds of positions, I would assume there's a strong correlation with intelligence. So if IQ tests really do measure anything that matters, and it is a bell curve distribution, what does it mean for schools to educate kids for this future world who aren't maybe that smart?
Well, there's social justice issues too. For example, I mean, these are kids who are from like, you know, urban LA, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of folks would just write them off.
Okay, but that's different because you
well,
have
right,
that
sure, absolutely.
Distribution, and so yep. providing opportunity for, you know, people that have strong internal capacities, capabilities, versus no matter where our students are that are not that skilled. I mean.
Yep.
It's a huge issue.
Sure.
That's a very unsettling comment for me because, for one thing, I know a little bit about intelligence tests, and I'm not sure they're either intelligent or test. But one of the promises of technology, it seems to me, is that it gives us the opportunity to give kids the opportunity more to show what they know. What they know how to do to be creative in different ways than the kinds of intelligence that get measured on the Wechsler intelligence scale or something like that. So it seems to me that there's a little bit of a catch-22 there. If you say that the new creative class is going to be the old intelligentsia. That's troublesome.
Yeah.
That's also the whole thing about digital literacy and literacy for the 21st century. Literacy today is defined, you know, reading comprehension, that sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so one might say, if one is more literate now, they are smarter. Well, if the definition of literacy changes, doesn't our definition, therefore, of smart change?
Right.
And it seems to, yes?
You mentioned the jobs are moving overseas, and we finished the Lord's Flat. Yes, very quickly. I saw a Gateway ad, and one of the things they noted was 100% North American tech supporter.
Yeah.
So is that an indication that there is a backlash now of that, so that those jobs that we consider lower quality jobs maybe weren't so much to a quality?
Yeah, I don't know. Because a lot of people are outsourcing.
Going to what Tom just said is that I have particular concerns as the definition of literacy changes, right? From being able to work with printed text to working with digital medias and communicating and with tools that, you know, don't exist yet, is that we know that we have particular school populations that are at risk of continuing to be marginalized, if not further marginalized, right? Rural schools, urban schools, etc. And so that's something I would like to hear somebody talk about, is just, you know, sort of what are our prospects for dealing with that issue in terms of the digital divide as we continue, not the digital divide in terms of access, but literally the digital divide in terms of these people being able to become fully participating citizens in the new creative society, the new technology-infused, globally interconnected society. Right? And I don't see a lot of movement in a lot of schools, in particular ones.
Well, you could argue both ways. You could argue that inexpensive technology is more, you could get out to more people, and if we could teach well, we are flattening
if it's happening.
But the other side of it is, but it's certainly, you know, we see students are saying it's not happening at these elite universities. So conclusion could be, you know, these elite universities are going to go out of business because it's going to go, because the value added of the tuition is just not there, and so they're going to go other places.
Yes,
I stayed quite as long as I could. I'm in a small rural southeast Oklahoma district, and we utilize a significant amount of technology, and my students, like the students in this video, are exposed on a daily basis to a lot of things, from Meritech to Skype to creating their videos, blogging, making their web pages, from fourth grade up.
Yeah.
Great. And I'm already starting to hear from my students as they go off to college, what happened? We're now at college. And what I heard in this video is what my students say was not so much the job skill set, it was the response that you're asking me to give you. I can give you a whole lot more if you'll think as a college instructor, beyond the box, not outside, but beyond, way out there, and let me respond to you in a way that adequately showcases my knowledge. If I have not met the requirements of that, then redirect me, but don't just squash my creativity, because I can't, so let me.
Chris Beatty, who's, I think it's safe to say, is our leading expert on state technology policy and national technology policy, came and gave a speech at Minnesota, and the one thing he said that really stuck with me is he said, these kids who have grown up with computers their entire lives are now hitting the colleges and universities, and we are wholly unprepared for them.
Yeah. I think that the question is, how does the university deal with the digital equity issues? Because once those children from your district go to college, they will be different from the children as far as preparedness is concerned, from District X, where they did not have as much exposure. But they will still be accepted into the same university because the criteria for acceptance will be the same.
And X is more the norm, right?
X is the norm.
Right. You're not the norm, you're the exception.
Well, and absolutely, but if we continue to do it the way we've always done it, we'll always get the same results as we've always gotten. So until people are willing to say, yes, you have this skill set, and I'm willing to respond to that skill set by saying that is a viable way to give me your feedback or your input as a student. The students continue to feel like this. And my students don't echo the,
we don't feel like we're being adequately prepared for the job market. That's not what I hear. I am totally frustrated writing 5-page essays double-spaced with references at the end.
You know, but what I hear, and I mean, I'm a technology advocate, and I'm not a big advocate of lecture, but we also have kids who have been brought up in this always-on environment. They haven't had time to be reflective. We as right. parents have not taught them how to be reflective and how to listen and think before they want to be engaged always. And so we, and I still value that. There's times where we need to not have that's some right. of this stuff in here.
Sure.
And what I saw those kids up there saying is that, you know, I'm text messaging while I'm playing my PlayStation 3 while my MP3 player is going on in my VW Bug, and you know, and they do. They're amazing. They can multitask like crazy, but I don't think we want colleges to look like that. Yes, we need to be much more in tune with the times. We need to be embedding much more technology-rich, creative ways to be learning and teaching. But I worry when I hear that you know, that we're going to have, okay, your new professor is PlayStation 3. You know, kind of, you sit here with a joystick and you learn kind of a thing. So,
but yeah, I think that.
No, hang on.
I would agree. I don't think it's a technology problem because I would put our university, any of our universities, against any of these high schools as to the amount of technology, the level of technology. It's a learning problem, and it's a learning problem for the professors. It's for us. We all have to learn, just as the students learn, and we have to continually learn and use this and adapt it to whatever we're trying to teach. That's the problem as I see it, not the technology.
Well, and the thing is you talk about technology. I've got a lot of schools that have technology in it. It's not impacting instruction because it's all they've done is automated it. It's just faster and more, not better.
Because their teachers weren't trained how to do it.
That's well,
right. And their leaders weren't trained how to work with the teachers to do it.
Because our technology policy has mostly been driven by what I call the field of dreams mentality. Yeah. Like if you build it, they will come. Well, they built it. Uh-huh. Nobody came.
And now we've
well, but that's that's not true. The fastest growing colleges now are online colleges. Mm-hmm. They're not the traditional colleges. Right. The students are going to where technology is.
Because the traditional colleges did what I said.
Yeah.
Well, they have all this technology, and none of the professors are using it. So kids are going elsewhere for their learning.
But the market economy is driving that.
Okay, so we've gotten a lot of context now. We've built context over quite a amount of time. Let's talk about what are we currently doing, right? Or what are we currently doing in terms of helping administrators, practicing administrators, new administrators, people who are thinking about being administrators, people who used to be administrators, whatever. What are we doing to help them be effective tech leaders? So let's talk about this. What are we doing right now? Like, what's happening? So, time to share some success stories.
That's what I do. I share success stories.
Well, good.
I tap into best practice. I'm new second year in Florida, but I've started to try to network and find out where are some of the areas that really new, innovative, unique, great things are doing. And then those of us in the room, we share each other. We share ideas, say, hey, you ought to go check this out on the web. And then that's the nice thing is that, you know, I can share with my students via a webcast or something a really cool thing that's happening in Oregon. And we don't have to go there or listen to them on the telephone. We can watch it and see it and experience it that way.
I do two things. One is, and this to me is the most important thing we can do, I share my learning with my students. And one of the ways I've been doing that this year is I set up a wiki for our doctoral program, and I send out a weekly email that says, check out the wiki, because what I do is I post weekly technology tips for school leaders. Technology tips for leaders one. And I just sort of share something that I learned through some blog I read, some email I got, something I read in eSchool News or something. So I'm constantly learning, and I'm sharing with my students what I'm learning so they can learn it as well. The other thing that I do, this came from a colleague, when I first started being as a professor, one of my colleagues said to me, don't be afraid to teach what you know. I didn't quite know what that meant until now. And for me, what that means now is, I think I know a lot about technology and education and change and all that stuff. So I'm going to teach through that. So in the fall, for example, now I teach a school law class. So what do I do in my exams, the midterm and the final exams? They're fact patterns that are about issues of technology that raise some of the law issues we talked about. When in the fall, I'm going to be teaching a politics of education class. So I'm going to teach the politics of education through the lens of technology policy. It's just a way for me to help them understand some of the issues through and to teach what I know wherever I can.
Okay. Two max rule, so let's hear from the audience. Something good is happening out there.
We're doing some reverse mentoring where students, both undergraduate and graduate students, are working with faculty on the technology side, helping them with projects. They're around whatever the faculty wants to work on, but it's where the students are then helping the faculty.
Roger, where are you?
Iowa State.
Okay. And what has caused faculty to move that direction? Like, what's the incentive or inclination? Like, what's driving
them? They get things done that they can't do themselves, and they see that they can't do it.
Okay.
And actually, it's some of the oldest, most senior faculty that are taking advantage of it, where they're not feeling insecure.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of that, though, going around, too.
Sure.
But saying, hey, we can all learn together. I know some things that you don't know as a student, but you know some things that I certainly don't know, and I want to do this project, and you know you can help me, but you can learn some things along the way. And they're developing great relationships, we'll say friendships.
So closer to that ideal of we're all lifelong learners, where the learning community is safe for us to admit what we don't know, and we have things we want to learn. So, yeah?
I was just going to say, a lot of my students, my graduate students, are digital refugees and Luddites and other Stone Age sort of thing. And so the very fact that we're requiring them to do things with technology is much more of a help than I think we get a credit. You know, you got to start somewhere. And that's where you got to start.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, let's say that. Okay. Matt, Sarah, something you want to share about? You're part of our panel.
Well, right.
oh, yeah.
I'm still here. The technology leadership program thing that I'm doing is really a set of electives. And one of the three credit classes are students on ground that in Charlottesville are being asked to take, but the majority of the people that are in my courses are technology-specific personnel out in schools. And they're very frustrated with the idea that they're the non-positional leader who knows more about technology. And so I think an interesting question is, what can we do to help non-positional leaders be more effective?
So what are we doing to help technologists be effective leaders?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Because they recognize quickly. They don't have to be taught about it to conceptualize
right.
what the problem is. They're not the authority in charge of the decision making, and they recognize that the person who is doesn't know anything about technology, nor necessarily feels a sense of responsibility to learn. They are practicing administrators. So they're sort of beyond the grasp of our programs because they're not the people going through it. And so I think that's a really important thing to help. And so the way I'm thinking about it is through, you know, like the distributed leadership concepts in theory and trying to get a good handle on, you know, how expertise is a position to lead from and such, because I just hear from technology personnel all the time how difficult it is for them to lead.
I was going to answer it from a different angle, and that is, I think some of my frustrations as coming into the university, being somewhat tech savvy and having the limitations. I mean, I remember when I first started teaching seventh grade, and the world I was just coming out, and wanting the school to move forward, you know, let's do something with it. And then when I became an administrator, and you know, and I feel like I'm the same. I feel constrained a lot in terms of being a tech savvy junior faculty member, trying to utilize technology in the best way I can, but don't have the infrastructure, the structure, nor the support. I mean, getting giggled at when you say, you know, we really need to have our classrooms need to be equipped. And these are what these need to be equipped with, not just the overhead.
Right.
Not just the overhead or the 13-inch Sylvania television set that you have to click. You know, and but that's, I mean, and the reality is, for many of us, that's what we're confined to. So I think what ends up happening with some of us is we have to find special projects to work with students on. You know, I'm working on a grant, so one of the, actually Carl, which is the room, is one of the evaluators for one of our grants, and we did some digital storytelling. And, you know, but I had to use a different grant money to buy the computer and to buy the equipment, and it had to be in my office because there's no technology place. I mean, you guys know the story.
Yeah. Okay, to Max. So.
What I want to do is just try to briefly go over the K-20 Center at the University of Oklahoma is affecting not pre-service administrators so much, but in-service
administrators.
And not technology administrators. These are administrators that are pretty much the digital refugees. And
they're in practice.
The program has now processed over 1,000 in the state. We're really looking at educational renewal. We're looking at educational change. We're looking at, and when it comes to technology, that's a very important part of the program, but that basically we're saying, don't even think about technology until you know how to integrate it, so you really know what you're doing with it. And that way, it requires a lot of change on the district level, a lot of new vision to be created, a new roadmap of how this technology is going to be integrated. And part of that is that, you know, the state doesn't have a lot of access to technology. So we want to make sure that the administrators, when they get technology, they have really thought about what they're doing.
Yes, we want them to think about their mission and their district and how that technology is going to help them reach that. So they are not just administrators who buy laptops for their schools and make their school districts wireless, but they need to know why and where it's going to take their teachers and where it will take their students. And then we provide the support.
Okay. One thing Sarah said really caught me. We have a very vibrant school technology program for teachers and in Florida, but we don't do a lot cross-departmental. That's the culture of colleges and universities. But I was asked to guest lecture in one of the professor's classes, and my class was at the same time, and I'm teaching Leading Change, and I teach it through kind of a technological lens as well. So after the class, the professor came up to me and said, you know what, my students, when they leave here, they know all this stuff. They know how to integrate technology, but they don't know how to get people to do it. They don't know how to lead change. So they don't have the leadership side. So I think what we need to do in leadership programs is to tap into some of the stuff that's starting to happen. Because even in your buildings, you know, when I was a fifth grade teacher, I was, you know, it was an Apple IIe, but I knew how to use it. But I didn't share it with anybody because, you know, I was a new teacher and everything. We need to really tap into those people that have the content knowledge, make them leaders, distribute the leadership, and be able to help them lead that change and lead that revolution in their schools.
I'm going to keep us moving forward. So I got another quote for you to sink your teeth into real quick. And then we'll move from what is to maybe what could be or what should be. What could we be doing that we're not doing to help? And now we're talking about the field of the leadership generally, particularly in preparation institutions, right? So what could our leadership programs be doing to help administrators be effective technology leadership? So what are some ideas we have to put out there? Right? Because we know that it's not happening in many of leadership programs across the country. So, Bob.
Well, I think to the point that David made earlier, which connected, I mean, there's a way in which technology people who know how to use technology could advise others on how to integrate it and why and such, need leadership skills. The leaders, positional leaders, administrators need the technology skills. And I think that, you know, some things about the programs that we could do through assignments
is asking people to do their work in different ways, both topically and having to, you know, build in, like, you've got to show a draft of materials, you got to prepare something that would be presenting to whatever, and take in the consultation of the technology specialist in your school, or have to present it to a small group and write up, you know, what reactions were. I mean, there's lots of ways. If part of the problem is people with, you know, everybody doesn't have the whole knowledge set, nor do they have a sense of needing to team necessarily in order to make a larger body of knowledge to draw upon and work with and make decisions in conjunction with. So one thing we could do from our programs is assign things differently and ask people, require them to have to communicate with, you know, and in a sense, you're sort of modeling what could be a distributed leadership knowledge base or a distributed knowledge base.
To follow up on this, I think that's a terrific idea. To the people who are really good at the IT department in our colleges, and how many of us invite the IT people to come in and help us teach our classes? But that would be modeling what you're proposing.
Well, and you don't even necessarily have to be that tech savvy to provide technology options for students, right? So, for example, I'm teaching the School and Society class right now for the College of Ed, which is the history, philosophy of Ed class taken by the pre-service teachers, right? So, we come time to do reflection on what they've learned so far, and so option one is write a, you know, 3-page type reflection. But options 2 and 3 are podcast or podcast with a buddy. Options 4 and 5 are digital video or digital video with a buddy. Option 6 is use mind mapping software and, you know, company with a, you know, tech staff. And I don't have to know how to do all those things as an instructor necessarily to let them be able to show the knowledge in different ways, like the students in the video.
But I think that's a really key point. I mean, picking up on what Sarah said and expanding. For us to teach, for the principal, then it's like the use of assessments right now. If we're, you know, the principals are feeling the burden, so they're bringing a new assessment, new form of assessments on board. But without being related to curriculum instruction, it's just going to be another layer of minutiae in the school. And so we can't just do the, you know, put another computer lab in the building. I think everybody's going to come there. How do we help the future leaders or the in-service current principals understand and not necessarily understand the technology themselves, but help them? Help the teachers understand to learn technology in content and in context, as opposed to saying, you know, want to let you know, buy a new mobile lab, it's down the hall, around the corner, see you when you get there, if you find your way there, and hope you don't just use it for word processing.
Right.
You know, having them showing, even as simple as communicating via supervision, that it's okay to open up your assignments, similar to what Sarah talked about at the higher education level, at the levels of the school. But I think that it's that implementation piece that I think we're starting at least to get over the phobia of technology. But now that we know that we need to enter into it at school, man, if I can't make teachers be nice to kids, how the hell am I going to make them use technology in really inclusive ways?
It's exactly what all of you have said. And the word that you said was the word that came to my mind when you asked that question, modeling. My teachers that I do in professional development, they don't want to know how. They want me to put feet to it and say, I'm doing it this way. It can be done this way. Let's do it this way together.
Okay.
As opposed to do it.
But let's broaden that to the idea of a leadership preparation program. Right? How do we model for other programs who don't even see us or don't even interact with us, right? I mean, we may have the most technology-infused, innovative leadership preparation program in the state of Minnesota, but that doesn't mean that the other colleges and universities within the state have any idea what we're doing or ever exposed to that, et cetera, right?
Well,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, buddy. No,
you get kicked out of the program tomorrow. But what we're doing is we got a very nice sized grant that integrates a lot of technology and combines agricultural science and biology. Teachers take a slide, emails it to the students, they'll have tablets, they annotate on it. Save and email back. Okay. I get no credit for that in my administrative program. I would love for that to be able to be sent to the K-20 Center. They chew it up, spit it out, copy it, submit their own grant, whatever. But see, I get no credit in my project, my program for that work, which I think
as a professor, as a faculty member.
Well, I'm a superintendent of a conference school.
Yeah.
So for my classwork.
Yeah. Okay.
And I would love for that to be a part of that what I could turn in as to get credit for my progress.
So you're saying as a student, the program could encourage you by letting you take applied
read,
work.
We have to read, and which I'm gaining tremendously from the reading. The reading I love, and I'm gaining from it, but then I turn around and just write a paper supporting what I've read as opposed to taking a project, I could have done the project, sent it in, then everyone can look at it.
Well, building upon that, I was thinking about, you know, when I have students do work, a lot of times what I tell them to make is a representation of what it was we were just studying, and I really leave it open-ended. And I say that the thing is, you've got to make your audience be, you know, like I have a lot of technology specialists, so the teachers, or if you're a district person, you may be dealing with the technology specialist, and whatever language, whatever format works for you, but your job is to produce for me something that communicates what we were just studying to that audience. And so you're sort of giving them a lot of incentive to then go on and present it to somebody else, because you're making them make something that then, when it's finished, is in fact a way that they can convey that knowledge on. And you know, it kind of relates to what you were just saying. If we open up the assignments, going back to this question, which you modified, but I want to go back to that question, the more we can, you know, have people producing things that, in fact, make it a lot easier for them to communicate, it forces them to articulate, it gets their materials together so they're ready to communicate it, because that's what gets people to put the time in to get themselves in a position to be able to lead about something concretely. And just one sort of analogous point is that when I was doing a PT3 grant that was about trying to get pre-service teachers to use technology, of course we're concerned about, do they actually use it when they go into field experiences? And we found that the highest predictor of whether or not they were going to use technology in their field experience, better predictor than technology support and equipment, was their supervising teacher at the, you know, university asked them to use it. They just assigned them to do it. Hello, that's what gets them to do it. They'll overcome other barriers. So that's what we should be doing at programs, if you ask me.
Grab your purple card. I want everybody to jot down one answer to this question. So take 60 seconds and what can our leadership programs be doing to help administrators be effective technology?
Just
whatever you can get down in 60 seconds.
Okay.
So new card, and I'm going to collect these from you on your way out the door.
At least one. They can count more than
one. Yeah, at least one.
Not just
one. Oh, we'll
at least one.
One.
Yeah.
Keep me honest.
There's only one way.
See if you can get the
right
answer.
You have to write it.
There's only one answer.
The correct answer.
Only 5 seconds.
We get all text messages, guys.
Yeah.
45
seconds.
Can we just text messages?
Yes, sir. Thank you. I'm taking notes on mine.
So that's one.
You're in Candy Cam.
It's an MP3 device, so everything you said is being recorded. Has been
twice.
All right, 30 seconds.
Uploaded to the web, it's supposed to be.
That's right. We're streaming live to your
podcast.
We're streaming live to your home institution, where the provost is living. Okay, as you finish up your responses, I'm going to throw out this question to our panelists. We're going to violate our GMAX rule here, but I want each panelist, within 30 seconds, to just offer your thoughts in terms of what kind of research do we need on tech leadership? What don't we know?
Well, it sounds like what I think we need to know is what I'm working on, and that is trying to understand better the mixture of authority and expertise about authority, you know, school, and expertise about technology and how that comes together in a distributed leadership team.
Okay. All right. Other thoughts?
I think you're going to disagree with me on this, Scott, but I think, and one of my doctoral students is going to do this, but I think we need to tell the stories, we need to produce good case studies of effective technology leaders. And a lot of that has been done, but not in a way that gets out to people. You know, the stories of the superintendent in Plano, Texas, and the principal of high school of the future. just show people, it's kind of the modeling idea, show people what's possible and what a good technology leader looks like.
Pat, David?
I think we need more research and kind of view, like you, this is what I'm doing, but on how do leaders effectively change the culture of their organizations to do these things that we know they need to do to be more effective with kids. So how do they take their role as leaders, understanding the culture, the climate that they live in, and be able to move that culture and climate to be more technologically literate and future-oriented and adaptable, all those things?
Yeah, I think we have a great opportunity here to use technology as one vehicle to do that. As with the buzzwords right now in schools are things like distributed leadership, professional learning communities, and using data, and I don't know what the hell any of those things mean. But when you start thinking about them in practice, in use, and uncovering the exploratory studies, and trying to conceptualize that those things in use, I think that we're taking one step closer to uncovering or unpacking at least what that looks like in practice.
Other thoughts? Couple responses from the audience.
I think just from a practicing principle, because I work with a lot of principals who are going to be returning students, you're going to have to show them how this is going to make change student learning. How is this going to affect student test scores? Because if it's not going to, it's not going to raise those reading scores or math scores, then they're not going to spend the time on it.
But that's reactionary, not future oriented.
But that's what you're dealing with.
That's
reality. Right. You know, and you can be all great and fine and pretty, but unless you convince them, you're not going to get anywhere with them. And hopefully maybe pre-service administrators you might be able to tackle.
I just haven't done it yet.
What about comment on the necessary research?
You made a comment about not being able to make them treat kids nice. Sometimes we're not going to move past some of the very basic things, and that's what the education hire.
I would say that we need better research and conceptualizations of what are we talking about when we say effective tech leadership? What do we mean? What are principals and superintendents and tech coordinators and new specialists and, what are they doing? How do we know when we see somebody say they're being an effective technology leader? How do we conceptualize that and characterize that? And we have some documents like the NSA that help explain some of that. But I think that's one aspect. The other key thing for me is this issue of scaling up, right? In every state, we have successful technology-oriented, future-oriented schools. What are successful mechanisms that scale that up to districts across the state so we have greater numbers, right? I mean, so we don't keep hearing about the same, handful of schools in each state that are doing great things or the same small handful of districts. But what is it going to take? And what are some models we have to make that happen at a larger scale? Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, as a beginning administrator, time is such a premium. And, if you know technology well, you can really harness that to do so many things. But I didn't learn any of that in any of my administrative coursework. So, I don't know I've had to learn how to mail merge to do my evaluation documents. Or you're doing data-driven decision making. Did I have a project that made me put that on an Excel spreadsheet? No. And so I see that just practical applications of technology, if I had gone into my role being a very proficient technology user and doing those kind of tasks, in turn, I think, I would be modeling that very effectively, and those would have been authentic learning projects for me as a student. So kind of see a lot of practical applications.
Good. That's a good segue into this next to last quote, so take a quick peek at what's on the screen. Yeah, these bloggers don't hold back. So finally, I'll leave you with this quote. I didn't introduce him, but Miguel Bulin, who's in the back of the room, is the technology integration person for the San Antonio School District, and this is his quote, actually on the left. No one jumps a 20-foot chasm. So I'll leave you with that thought and this diagram. Thank you for attending our symposium. If you will leave your clickers and your purple index cards on the way out, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right.
Good job, modeling.